accession number 23216, reel 10.
Colonel Corbould, reel 10. You're saying that you're working for the staff at 38 group, but you're also in close contact with 3rd Division.
Yes, and we worked in a great deal with them, and nearly all our contingency planning was really bound up with 3DIV, then commanded by General Charles Harrington.
But within 3DIV, presumably it would be the 16th Independent Parachute Brigade Group, would be the force for contingencies.
Correct, yes.
First instance.
And 16th Parachute at that time was commanded by Brigadier Napier Crookenden, our retired Lieutenant General.
Did you have any contact or liaison with the Marines? Because they were also a force of contingencies.
I've never had any contact with the Marines at all during my health service, no.
How was business done on the staff of 38 Group? Did you have a briefing every morning, or O groups regularly, or conferences, or were you...
We had a SASO meeting every afternoon at 4 o'clock, yes. And that's when all plans were put, or our day's work was being discussed, and contingency planning talked about. And we'd all be asked what we'd actually been doing, and what our views were. And so, yes, it was a totally integrated group. When we met together, a good deal. We were a very close-knit group indeed.
How many people would there be at that meeting?
There would be not necessarily the AOC, but certainly SASO. And then there would be our colonel and myself and my RESC colleague. And then the airman who I used to work with as well. Colin Watson by name, who would give purely the Air Force side of the aircraft and so on and so forth. There would be a technical man there, a weatherman, and an admin man. So in all, the best part of a dozen people.
How long did the meeting usually last?
Oh, probably about an hour.
Did it follow a set formula?
No. It didn't. I mean, it entirely depended on what was going on, what was on the books, or had anything been received through 3DIV or the joint staffs who wanted us to go and examine a certain project. That would all come out initially there.
And you would then have to form a view, and somebody presumably would have to summarise it and send it up.
That's right, and then that would be given a certain amount of time to do that.
Yes.
And it might be necessary in the meantime, before things could be summarised, that Corbould or someone rather would have to go off to whatever it was.
And have a look.
Mm.
Did you find yourself framing draft or final operational orders as a result of these trips?
With the airman, I did, yes.
So it would be the two of you?
It was sitting together, and he'd be doing the Air Force side, I'd be doing the Army side, yes. And then that would be all gone through with the colonel, our colonel GS, Morris Hall by name, and the vice marshal, the SASO.
Did you ever find that there were linguistic difficulties when you were trying to frame orders with the Air Force, or were you using language in the same way?
Oh, we didn't have any trouble like that at all. No. Our phraseology, I found, was pretty well exactly the same. I think that's always been the case, hasn't it, Nigel? I mean, I don't know whether the Navy used a different phraseology to what we use. I don't know. But
well, I think there have been times when the services have had their own private languages, as it were.
Yes, but I think this was one of the reasons why 38 Group was formed, so we could form a common language to form a common plan.
You could thrash things out.
We all understood what we were all saying. Yes.
Did you ever have any serious clash of interest with your Air Force colleagues while you were making plans?
Priorities occur?
Yes.
No. It was a very easy. It was very easy working with them entirely. But I can't remember any real big confrontation at all. Only when I shot off my mouth, when I oughtn't to have done.
Oh well, that was an operational decision, wasn't it?
That was an operational decision. Yes.
Now, apart from that regular daily meeting in the afternoon, how else would you spend a normal day if you were in the group headquarters? What would you be doing? Would you be working on the telephone or by face-to-face meeting or writing letters and writing memoranda? Or
routine. Duties. Telephone. Lived on the telephone. Yes.
Lived on the telephone.
Or one would have to go and say, for example, I was working on a certain project or a contingency plan. I want some technical knowledge. I go and spend an afternoon with the Wing Commander Technical and get him to put down what I was supposed to find out, and thereby mix another plan accordingly. It became quite technical at times.
What sort of technical matters would come up?
Well, it's a question of the refueling of aircraft, for example, spare parts, the maintenance of aircraft, air crews. Oh, this is where we came up against it. We found that the air crew could only fly for X number of hours a day, else they wouldn't allow them to fly anymore. Now, this is really, as we in the Army used to say behind their backs, this is a trade union. Mm. This won't do at all. And so we had to somehow get around that.
Did you ever have to use double crews to achieve range and timing?
Yes, we did, yes. Yes, we did. Which we in the Army thought, well, this is really quite ridiculous. Surely they can go a bit longer than that. But they are the professional airmen, and they were very good airmen too. Mm. So one had to bow to what they said.
Were there ever any cases where, as a contingency, the idea was that the airborne forces should seize a base for air operations as such, rather than it being the other way around with the Air Force providing a bus service for the...
No, I don't remember that at all. I think we'd have been left out of that completely, the Army side of it. They'd have done it entirely on their own.
What, using the RAF regiment as their...
That sort of thing, yes, yes. Yes. I mean, the RAF regiment, you didn't quite know, again, you see, the Royal Air Force regiment should really be transferred to the parachute regiment, because a lot of them are qualified parachute shooters.
Well, their officers used to train here at Sandhurst.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, did they?
Go to the School of Infantry, yes.
That's what they did, yes, yeah. Yes.
From time to time, there still is one, as a sort of
yes.
exotic bird of passage.
But you still have an RAF liaison officer.
Of always. There's always at least a platoon commander who's Royal Air Force, in the same way as there's always at least one naval officer.
Well, when my present wife, who was married to a Royal Air Force officer, he, as a squadron leader, was the RAF liaison officer here. Attenders.
Mm. And of course, there are also there were always naval and air force officers at Camberley as well.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes, always, yes, yes, yes.
Do you remember there being any significant operations launched while you were at 38 Group? You know, plans actually put into action?
No. The only thing was this enormous exercise when we first joined, Exercise Starlight in the Desert, which was a vast 38 Group. A three-day of exercise.
Where did that take place?
From El Adam, and the landing grounds at Tamimi, and our getting out towards, I suppose, Tobruk. Mm. This was in 1960.
Did that involve any contact with the Libyans?
No. In no way at all. No, we kept them well.
Purely British exercise.
Purely British exercise, yes, yes.
What about the Americans? Because I think they had a presence in...
During that time, we never had any liaison with the Americans at all. Mm. And that, in retrospect, I find a little bit rather strange. Mm. But I don't remember having any liaison with the Americans at all while I was at 38 Group.
How did this exercise go? What was being practiced? Was it deploying a division by air, or was it some other...
Deploying a division by air, and also getting lots of aircraft into the desert. Oh. And all that goes with that, you know, sort of... could the aircraft stand up to all the sand and dust and God knows what? Yeah.
A very important question.
A very important question indeed, yes. And as far as I know, the Beverly was a great aircraft in those days. It stood up to it very well. But being to me, when three Beverleys were landing, it was quite a performance, actually. You couldn't see for about a day.
And was that because of the dust they kicked up?
Yeah, the terrific dust, yes, yes, yes.
How many men could you get into a Beverly? What sort of load?
Well, as far as parachuting is concerned, you would have sticks of 20, port and starboard, 40 people, and then in the boom, which is where the boom is used by support company, my company, because all our stuff that we drop, the heavy drop, the guns, machine guns, signals, mortars and so on, would all be in the main part of the aircraft, and we'd be up in the boom, and we'd drop first through the hole in the floor, and as soon as the last man had gone, the lever was pulled, and out came all the heavy drop.
And that come out on rollers, would it?
Yes, yes, on platforms.
Platforms.
All of which, of course, we had to load ourselves.
Mm. So you were concerned with the rigging? And
with the rigging, yes. That's what I was looking for, yes. Mm.
What sort of response times, then, could you achieve if you were given a warning order, say, you know, that you're going to have to go off to...
Timbuktu
or...
Well, the rigging would be depending on how much we were using, we used to spend nearly a complete day or night, or day and night, rigging, non-stop, pretty well. And then we'd be all set to go.
And, but then you'd have the business of loading, wouldn't you?
That's right.
The aircraft.
And having to take from where it actually loaded to the actual place where the aircraft were, load them all into the aircraft, which would take another day or two.
So it's quite like been moving stuff from Aldershot, wouldn't it?
Yes.
And then loading it up.
That's right. Or to Abingdon.
Or to Abingdon.
Mm. Oh, yes, a number of times when we've been through all the early hours of the morning.
Driving to Abingdon.
Driving to Abingdon or to Abingdon, particularly Abingdon.
Was there any use of Blackbush at that time, or was it contemplated as a
the only time
possible
I ever,
reserve?
The only time I ever emplaned at Blackbush for parachuting was when we were doing night jumps, training night jumps with one para.
But presumably it was there as a facility.
Yes, but it was never. It wasn't any time we ever used it for was for training. Mm. We never. I never as commanding support company. I never had to load any of my company group at Blackbush at all.
Yes.
Mm. Well, I think it's probably about enough of 38 group, isn't it by now?
I was going to say, what happened to you after 38 group?
38 group. I then had to go back to. I was. Told that then that every parachute regiment officer had to serve with a TA.
Ah.
And so I was then, being a guardsman, I was sent to 10 Para in London, which had a great guards connection. Mm. And so in 1962, I was sent to 10 Para in London as the training major, as they called it in those days. And that lasted for 2 years exactly, the whole of 62 and the whole of 63. And we had a very strong battalion in 10 Para.
I was going to ask about the strength and the state of recruiting.
Well, it was very good indeed. I mean, I think our battalion strength never fell below about 800 chaps. Mind, if the bugle sounded with a clear note, it would be 800 chaps. That wasn't necessarily the case. But it was a very strong battalion indeed. And in those days, we had a territorial battalion in Scotland, 15 Para. We had 12, 13 Para in the Midlands. And 10 Para in London.
What sort of people would join 10 Para?
From all walks of life. The city, dustmen, literally all walks of life. Mm. Our officers mainly came from city and firms and so on. They say all in the city, but I mean, they were all people who worked in London in offices and so on and so forth. And the soldiery came from all walks of life. I mean,
what was it that attracted them?
And it was the adventure. When I first joined up with all these territories, I never would understand them at all. Their whole ethos seemed to be totally different to what I'd been used to.
How was that? What was about the ethos?
Well, I thought that this slightly bit of the trade union business came into it, mm-hmm. And I had a TA commanding officer who was a personnel officer at BA, mm-hmm. And a very pleasant man indeed. But he'd suddenly say, "I want to have a meeting. I want no regular officers there at all. I want to have all the people on my own." And I used to say, well, I'm very sorry, but I mean, this is not on at all. We are your permanent staff. We must know what you're talking about. And this did cause a lot of friction. And so much so that I really had to go to him one day and say, I want to see you. And I went to his office at BA, who calls in Buckingham Palace Road, and I really opened up. And that cleared the air a great deal.
Mm. How did he take to being rifted by his training major?
He didn't seem to mind it very much. I put in the odd sir.
You are useless, sir. You are doing this wrongly, sir. Is that the
well, I said to him, I think you must want to take my... I'm here to advise you. Mm. I said, I'm not exactly a young soldier. I didn't know what I'm talking about. Mm. But I said, we've got to get rid of this trade union movement. We are all one team, and you're the captain of the team. Mm. Now, come on.
What was this chap's background? Had he served...
He'd been a soldier... before the war in Palestine with the Royals, and he had a bit of a chip on his shoulder. He couldn't get to Sandhurst before the war. Oh. And he had a bit of a chip on his shoulder. And I fluffed this very quickly on indeed and thought, I had to play this very, very carefully indeed. Mm. And I was very tactful with him indeed. And other than the fact that when he started having these meetings, which I objected to very strongly, I was about to go and see the Brigadier Tony Dean Drummond. I didn't want to, in fact, involve him with that. So I thought to myself, Corbett, you must deal with this yourself. Mm.
Do you know why he was concerned to have these exclusive meetings?
I just don't know at all, I'm sure.
He didn't give any explanation.
No explanation at all.
About.
It was all talking sort of mumbo jumbo. I don't want it. Whether I mean, I must be very careful what I say. Are you a Mason?
Absolutely not.
Nor am I. Well, he was a Roman Catholic, and of course, and I'm not a Roman Catholic, but I mean, I have the highest regard for the Roman Catholics. But I think he was a little bit on that side. And one or two other people who were with him were RC chaps. You see, it was a little bit of that trade union business going on there. And so, anyway, I put a stop to it.
What about the other officers? Were they all experienced one way or another?
One or two of them had been regular officers, yes, and joined the TAS, yes. Mm. And we had one chap, in fact, he's a tremendous man in the, he got a decoration the other day, a CB, in the butchering world. He's I don't know what on earth he calls himself, but he's a great nabob in the butchering world, I do know that. Mm. And, of course, railing in money and so on. And we had a most excellent doctor, and he was on the staff of the Luton and Dunstable Hospital, so he used to come down, and he was a very good doctor indeed.
Quite a wide catchment area.
Oh, yeah, very wide
catchment area. As far as Luton.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yes. One chap, when the gosh, what am I trying to think of now? The politicians got into terrible trouble with that girl.
Oh, John Perfumer.
John Perfumer. Yeah. When that came up for the boil, one of our chaps worked in this city. And he came into me one day at lunchtime. He said, I've got news for you. He said, there's going to be this tremendous rumpus. He could even bring the government down. And he told me then what the story was.
Had you heard about it?
No, hadn't heard about it at all. Although he was the Secretary for Defence, or War, anyway, he was called.
How this chap got his inside knowledge?
I don't
then?
Know at all. But he said, he worked in Fleet Street.
Ah, that beard. Yes,
yes. Mm. I can remember his name, but I won't mention his name. But he came and said, to watch it. It's probably out in the news this evening, and it was, too.
You said that you had no trouble recruiting in Ten Para. Did you have a turnover, or did people tend to stay in once they joined?
Well, they stayed in, and they liked their own companies. We had a company in Croydon. Mm. We had a company, first of all, our botanical quarters was the White City. Mm. We were midway between the White City Stadium and the BBC. We were a funny little, no longer there now, there was a funny little barracks there. Mm. That's where Botanic Quarters was. So we had a company in Finchley, we had a company in Croydon, we had a company down the road on Shepherd's Bush in Bulwer Street, and two other companies. And we had one out in Essex. And one was continually, talk about getting on the move, I used to drive through around London in circles every day, virtually. And suddenly used to go to a different drill hall every week.
What was the level of skill and training like?
It wasn't bad. Before I got there, it had been commanded by a regular officer called Glyn Gilbert, who became a general. And Glyn had brought this battalion up to a very fine pitch of training by working very hard himself. And so it wasn't too bad at all. He personally picked all the company commanders. He also picked me to go and be the training major after he'd gone. Sorry, it sounds like I'm patting myself on the back, but that was the case. Mm. And so, I found that they were pretty good. And, of course, we had a PSI with every company, a regular
staff
soldier.
Instructor.
Yeah, permanent staff instructor.
Would he be a warrant officer?
No, a sergeant.
Sergeant.
Mm. We had a regular regiment sergeant major, who worked from battalion quarters, and he'd go around all the drill halls as well.
Were they from parachute regiment?
Oh, all parachute regiment. All parachute regiment, yes. Mm. And by this time, I'd been transferred to the parachute regiment.
Permanently,
yes. And so it was really quite good. And we, on the years that I was there, we did one year, we did an enormous exercise in Cyprus as a brigade, actually, up in the Troodos Mountains and so on and so forth. We did a lot of parachuting out there, the Morpho DZ. And then my last year with 10 Para, we dropped in on Rhine Army manoeuvres at dawn one morning near Osnabrück.
What were you practicing in Cyprus in the Troodos? Was this conventional warfare?
Conventional warfare, yes, yes. And to get give the chaps some sort of to get them out of England. Mm. And it was a very useful month we spent there. Well, nearly a month. We were there a month because we obviously had to be there before the troops and after the troops had gone.
But they would presumably be there for what? For fortnight.
Fortnight, yes, yes, yes.
What was the scenario of the exercise near Osnabrück when you joined?
Well, this, of course, was all bound up with Rhine Army manoeuvres. We were told to go in and, we again, had to do a very quick battalion attack on arrival. Mm. So we had to RV very quickly indeed, and be on our way to our objective.
Was this, in theory, a sort of disruption attack on the rear of an attacking Warsaw Pact army?
Yes, that sort of thing. Yes. That's exactly what it was. Mm. And the brigadier there was a man called Philip Tarr, who became the commandant here. Do you remember Philip Tarr?
He was Gunner, wasn't he?
Gunner, yes.
And he was before my time.
Yes. Mm. Well, he was commanding 11th Brigade at that time.
Yes.
And that we were really under his command. And we dropped really in support of his brigade and did a lot of disruption work.
Mm. Was that at a battalion level or broken up into smaller parties?
No, at battalion level, company by company.
Company by company.
Yeah, every company was given its own objective. Mm. And it was a very good exercise indeed, and the chaps thoroughly enjoyed it and learnt a great deal too. Mm. It went on for about a week. Well, yeah, just on about five days.
Was this related to the battalion's mobilisation role?
Yes, it was, because we would have dropped, had it, the Warsaw Pact swung into action, we'd have been dropped there, yes, certainly. Now, of course, you've heard Mike Gray will tell you more about this, because he became brigade major of the 44 Para Brigade, I think you'll find.
I think that was later on there, 1970s probably.
Was it? No, it probably was about 10 years later.
Yeah, I think it was after he'd commanded 1st Para in Northern Ireland. And
I begin to forget, of course, that I'm so much older than Mike.
Senior.
No, older, not senior. Oh dear.
How did they perform when they got into the field? I mean, how would they compare with regulars in getting themselves?
They weren't bad at all, Nigel. They were not at all bad. They were very good. They got themselves fit, and knew that. But of course, some of their actual SOPs weren't all that good. Mm. But we'd rehearse them as much as we possibly could. Yeah. But for territorials, they were very good indeed, I think.
How did they manage to keep themselves fit? Because presumably they had ordinary civilian occupations.
Well, they did. I think a lot of them just go down to a gymnasium in the evening and so on. They knew they were required to be very fit indeed. Mm. We used to have given a lot of synthetic parachute training.
Yes.
Iron Lord Tot or somewhere like that, you know. Mm. And they reacted very well indeed. And, of course, their families didn't seem to mind at all. Mm. I mean, if they're working very hard in their offices, then we used to demand that as soon as they put one foot inside the drill hall, wherever it was, they were soldiers, and they were treated as soldiers immediately. There was any way to do it.
So it was a change of life then.
Absolutely, change of life. Completely, as they went through the door, and they got quite used to this. Mm. No, I'm. In the end, I got to quite enjoy being with them, but 2 years was quite enough because one was on duty the whole time, and they would always come in at lunchtime into the drill hall, botanical hall, and ask questions and so on and so forth. So you were there almost 7 days a week.
Presumably, you'd be there morning and evening as
well. Oh yes. Oh yes. Lord, yes.
What time of day did they do their normal training? Would it be?
They would arrive at 7 o'clock in the evening.
Nine,
until nine. Well, much later than that, yes.
Much later.
I mean, on drill nights. I mean, yes. I wouldn't be home until midnight. Mm. We lived in a quarter in Putney at that time.
So would each drill hall have its drill night on a separate day of the week?
Yes.
And would you be expected to be going round to all of them every week?
No, not all of them.
Not all of them.
One would go to one each week. So, I mean, I'd visit each company once a month. Mm. Mind you, I was in close touch, because we have a weekly meeting with the PSIs, who'd all come in to battalion quarters for briefing and so on and so forth. And I'd be on the telephone to the PSI every day.
Mm. Did you follow the same sort of annual cycle as the regulars did, as, you know, insofar as you could, with regard to training?
As near as one could. As near as one possibly could, yes.
Who set the training programme? Was that down to you personally?
No, it was done by the commanding officer, but we were given direction by the brigade commander, who would say exactly what he wanted each battalion to do. Then the commanding officer, with some help, would write out the actual instruction.
What were your priorities then in training? What were the things that you considered most important?
Well, I suppose first and foremost, you've got to keep the chap fit.
Keep him fit. And after you, you know,
and then also to make quite certain that they could shoot.
Fitness, shooting.
I suppose. Well, what else can I think of? All the basics. Mm. As a guardsman, I used to make them drill. Mm. Quick reaction to discipline.
Yeah.
And those were the main things, all the basics. And we'd run recruit courses, and also because we'd run NCO courses as well. I mean, particularly the weekends, we'd let some of the officers go out and we'd say, well, you must do X, Y, and Z. Now, I'm going to take the NCOs now on section tactics or platoon tactics. And you have a sand table. It was quite a performance, I can tell you.
What about the practical side of doing tactics? Could you get them out for toots or for actual practice runs through section and platoon drills?
Not very much, no. Not very much. But one could do it on a sand table.
Yes.
We had to do a good deal of that. Yes, we had weekend exercises, certainly. Mm. Oh, yes, we had weekend exercises.
Where could you go for those?
Well, we'd go down to Aldershot and go on the ranges there. And we'd use the training areas at Aldershot too. Mm. And being up in London, it was very easy to do that. And we'd arrive down there on a Friday night and go back on a Sunday night. Mm. And work them like hell in the intervening hours.
So they'd be running about on Hankley Common.
That sort of thing, yes. And digging in. Mm. And spending a night out in the open, this sort of thing. Dawn attacks, that was a great thing.
Were you able to get enemies to play against them for these weekend efforts?
On one occasion, I think I did get some chaps from the Guards Depot to come out, yes. But that was rather infrequent. Mm. I can only remember doing that once. Mm. But... yes, it was. It was a tremendous challenge, really, as a professional soldier, to have to do all these things with people that you had to really carry along with you.
Did you find that the style of discipline differed from that prevalent in the regular army?
Oh, yes, it had to a certain extent. Yes, yes. One had to be more. I think one had to be more flexible. I mean, you'd issue an order, and chaps would say, "Why this or why that." Well, that's fair enough. Whereas in the regular battalion, he wouldn't ask that question. Mm. But I mean, so one had to be rather more expressive.
Yes.
Which was very good for one to be able to do that.
Mm. Well, I mean, there are occasions, aren't there, when regular soldiers will say, "Excuse me, sir, why are we doing this?"
Well, that's right.
You have to be able to explain.
Oh yes, you knew you were saying, "Because I bloody want to say it." So that's no good at all. Mm. You've got to say for the following reasons: X, Y, and Z. Mm. But it was more so with the territorial...
More inclined to question,
yes. Mm. And, of course, you've got to remember also at that stage, in 1962, 63, the intelligence was of a higher standard, basically, basic intelligence, than Thomas Atkins in the regular army.
Yeah, indeed. What about the social side of the...
Oh, yes, there was always...
Was that strongly supported?
Oh, we would have a dinner night in the mess, I think about every 2 months, something like that. Mm. We'd have company smokers and that type of thing, yes. And all the very important to get the wives along. Oh. And to chat them up and say, "Your chap's doing so well and well, thank you so much," etc. The little charm tapping on
that. With the home comfort side of things.
That's right. Very important indeed, yes. Mm. Very important. Mm. So it was really a very pleasant teamwork indeed, but I would not want to return to the TA itself. 2 years is quite enough. Mm.
What happened to you after the TA then? When you
then after then off? And then I was made regimental adjutant of the parish regiment.
What is a regimental adjutant compared
well,
to?
Well, he administers to all battalions, both regular and territorial, of the parish regiment, and he has the adjutants of all battalions under his thumb.
Well, that's an awful lot of adjutants to try and control.
It is, yes.
And there's nothing worse than a poacher turned gamekeeper, is there?
That's right. But I mean, obviously, one left the regular battalions to the adjutants to their commanding officer.
Yes.
But I mean, there was tremendous liaison between all of us, and it was. I really enjoyed being the regimental adjutant because one was in on all regimental affairs, from it involved the colonel commandant, and right the way down through the chain of command, and that was very good. I did it for 2 years.
Was that mainly administration supervision?
Mainly administration supervision, yes, and of course terribly important as well, the selection of officers too, very important indeed. Because they were coming straight in. We still took them on secondment, but some were coming straight from here.
Oh, yes.
And one of the first officers we had was John Ridgway, who rode the Atlantic from Sandhurst.
How did you actually choose them? What sort of tests did you put them through?